Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host, Divya Murali, a research associate at the Institute. Today's episode is on the recently concluded World Trade Organization's ministerial meeting. WTO's 13th ministerial conference concluded on 2nd March 2024 in Abu Dhabi. The declaration shows progress and commitment of the member states on issues like dispute reform and special and differential treatment provisions for developing and least developed countries. However, consensus on long-standing key issues continue to remain evasive. Ms. R.V. Anuradha, partner at Claris Law Associates New Delhi, has joined me in conversation today to throw some light on the developments from MC13 and what it means for India and the developing countries. Welcome, Anuradha.
Thanks, Divya. Happy to be part of the podcast.
To get things started, what are your general thoughts on the outcomes from the 13th ministerial in Abu Dhabi? What do you think are the hits and the misses?
Well, Divya, I think you would agree that we need to see MC13 in the context of shifting geopolitical challenges to international trade. There's been a definite repurposing or rechanneling of negotiating focus to bilateral and plurilateral agreements. That's the wave that we've seen, particularly in the past few years. But in that context, to think of 166 countries of the WTO, I mean, it was 164 and then two other new members who acceded during the ministerial, to see them come together and commit themselves to hard negotiations over 5 days. It was supposed to end on 29th and it got extended by a day. And, you know, given that kind of a commitment, I think that in itself is a vote for confidence in the continued relevance of WTO and multilateralism. And just in terms of broad statistics, these 166 countries represent close to 98% of global trade and global GDP. And it's in their interest to ensure that the rules of the WTO framework continue in terms of ensuring stability and predictability. So if you look at it in that sense, it's not really necessary for WTO to have announcements of new agreements or new conclusions at every biennial conference. It's a little bit of, I think the weight of expectations is way too high. And it, particularly in the context of, you know, what we've seen in media reports over the last few days, which seem to express a certain degree of pessimism that are headlines as if, you know, whether WTO continues to remain relevant or not. And that's where I want to emphasize that the WTO is actually a framework of existing thriving agreements that are being enforced, that are being, actually implemented as we speak. So the purpose of the ministerials in that context really needs to be looked at with a little bit of tempered expectations. There's much to celebrate in this, you know, 29th year of WTO's existence. And in that context, what we see in the negotiations is really more of incremental progress on some very, very difficult issues. So your question on hits and misses, hits very quickly. We have the conclusion of the services domestic regulations. Now, this is something which emerges out of the WTO's General Agreement on Trade and Services. It actually is a multilateral mandate, but because of change of dynamics and, shift in focus, a group of countries branched this off in 2017 at the Buenos Aires Ministerial as a side discipline, what they call the Joint Informal Discipline and Negotiations on Domestic Regulations. So as of now, this group has 71 signatory countries, or maybe 72. The thrust is predominantly on procedural efficiencies and streamlining procedural requirements on domestic regulations, such as those that apply to, you know, licensing and qualification for actually delivery of trade and services. The thrust is more on, you know, obligations relating to publications, timely approvals. The signatory countries would need to apply this on an MFN basis to all WTO members. And they'll need to incorporate it into their schedule of commitments under the WTO's General Agreement on Trade and Services. That, I think, is a significant hit. The other, of course, which has been reported very widely, is the extension of the moratorium on e-commerce. And then, equally important that I would emphasize is the extension of the moratorium in respect of non-violation complaints under the TRIPS agreement. In terms of misses, well, again, no surprise. The top of my list would be the issue of dispute settlement reform. The previous ministerial had this ambiguous wording that 2024 is the deadline for, or is the target date for arriving at reviving the dispute settlement system at the WTO. This is something to give a very broad context to the listeners. The dispute settlement system at the WTO has always been hailed to be the crown jewel of the WTO system. It worked brilliantly till 2019 as a two-tier system. There is a panel level and there is an appellate body, a permanent appellate body constituting 7 members. The appointment of those 7 members happens through consensus. Now, since 2019, the United States has essentially held up the appointment of appellate body members, arguing that the existence of the appellate body itself needs to be reviewed, that it's leading to over-judicialization of what should essentially be a member-driven process, and so on and so forth. And it's been a stalemate since 2019. There was an expectation that there would be some progress and revival of the appellate body, or at least the dispute settlement system in a functional form. A lot of options have been placed on the table. But unfortunately, most of those negotiations happened through what is called an informal process. If I have to put a positive spin to it or an optimistic spin to it, the only relevant part or progress that happened at MC13 was to acknowledge that this now needs to shift to become a formalized process within the WTO through member submissions. And the target is still kept as 2024. So we have, well, the next 10 months to hopefully have a concrete resolution to this issue. But again, very, very practically speaking, with the United States elections coming up in November, I'm not very sure whether the December deadline is realistic at all. But yes, it's out there. Another significant miss for developing countries like India is that we are still waiting for a permanent solution on what is called the Bali Peace Clause. And this is something which deals with public stock holding for food security purposes. This has been a long-standing demand since 2013. So it's over what, 10 years, 11 years now. There is actually an agreed text of what the permanent solution should look like, which has the endorsement of over 80 developing members, and yet it remains to be achieved. So that, to my mind, is a significant miss.
Thanks, Anuradha, for giving us a quick snapshot. So I just want to pick on the pieces that you mentioned on the hits and the misses. You did mention about the e-commerce moratorium. Now, that has been a long-standing issue where the WTO members have not been able to achieve a permanent sort of a consensus. So the moratorium does keep the cross-border electronic trade tariff free since 1998. India, South Africa, and Indonesia sees the moratorium as necessary to keep things affordable and to bridge digital divide in developing world, while the advanced economies see it as a revenue loss for them. What is your take on this, and why has it been difficult, you think, to have any long-standing outcomes from the ministerial meetings on this agenda historically?
Well, as you said, Divya, the e-commerce moratorium is basically a commitment not to place tariffs and custom duty on electronic transmissions. And historically, yes, it's been an easy extension year on year. I mean, at every biennial conference of the WTO since 1998. But in the recent past, with the growth of digital trade, digital industrialization, there's been a growing realization that this space is dominated only by a few actors, which are located in developed countries, and that there could be a significant revenue loss for countries like India, South Africa, Indonesia, in terms of if this moratorium is indefinitely continued. Indonesia, in fact, actually put a law in place that would allow the imposition of duties on digital goods, which it broadly describes as software, electronic data, multimedia transmissions, etc. I think this debate has, as of now, perhaps we've crossed the bridge for now, but there is significant pressure at the WTO to get clarity on a variety of issues. To give a very simple example, I think it is important to separate out what is the scope and ambit of the moratorium itself. In fact, there's no definition of what electronic transmissions would constitute. And there is a fear, there is somewhat aggravated by statements made by the EU, that the extension of this would also, in a sense, negate some of the policy space that developing countries have preserved under the General Agreement on Trade and Services for what we call the cross-border delivery of services. So, for example, under the GATS instrumentality, there is policy space that can be preserved for the purpose of delivery of services through electronic means. Now, clearly, the concept of customs duties do not extend to this, but at the same time, countries which have reserved policy space for market access restrictions or national treatment restrictions should be able to do so. Now, I think if this conceptual clarity is something that is brought in over the next 2 years in terms of what really is the scope and ambit of the moratorium, I really think that countries could perhaps have a more clearer and a permanent solution to this whole issue. There appears to be an accelerated focus on a work program, and there is an expectation that hopefully by the next conference, there should be some further certainty on how the future of the moratorium would look like.
You mentioned about the TRIPS non-violation agreement. That has been one of the asks of the developing countries. Could you speak a bit more on that?
Thanks, Divya. See, the under the TRIPS agreement, there was one of the provisions actually spoke about the fact that there will be no non-violation complaints in relation to obligations arising under the TRIPS agreement. And this was to apply till 1999. Now, what does this mean? The WTO recognizes under other agreements also that in some situations, even if the letter of an agreement is not breached, there could be a violation implicitly in the nature of a particular measure that is taken. Now, in the context of TRIPS, this becomes a very, very sensitive and complex issue. TRIPS, as you know, provides for a framework of granting of intellectual property rights on, patents, trademarks, copyrights, etc. But particularly in the context of patents, it's been a very sensitive issue for developing countries, including India. One of the biggest obligations was to extend the nature of the patents to product patents as well. And we now all have very well-fledged regimes which are TRIPS compliant. Now imagine a situation where this obligation is completely fulfilled, but at the same time, there is an exercise of policy space, which is completely consistent with the letter of the TRIPS agreement, but which could adversely impact a particular entity of these situations could typically arise in the context of high technologies or pharmaceutical, etc. In that context, having a non-violation complaint becomes a fairly tricky issue because it would actually delve into a realm of being compliant with the agreement and yet having a dispute relating to the fact that there is a breach of a implicit breach of an obligation. Now, developing countries like India have a strong interest, therefore, in the continuation of the moratorium on non-violation complaints. And the way this worked out traditionally since 1999 has been that there's been an implicit linkage that the e-commerce moratorium would be extended, which is in the interest of developed countries, and the TRIPS non-violation complaints would also be extended because that's in the interest of developing countries. Now, this has never been explicitly linked, but that implicit linkage is there. Now, Now we are looking at a situation where countries like India, South Africa, Indonesia are now asking for a relook at the continuation of the e-commerce moratorium. But equally, the relevance of the TRIPS non-violation complaint moratorium is important. So how do we negotiate this? How do we ensure that this is continued in order to have the development space for development of patents and related technologies within our own countries is also a critical issue which will need to be emphasized on. And I'm assuming that this will continue to get more relevance before the next ministerial.
So, in the past few years, India has been under the spotlight for taking some firm stances on issues, say, for instance, on agriculture. It has also firmly pushed back against the investment facilitation for development mooted by select countries. What implications does this have for India by way its stance and by extension to the global south, of which it is increasingly seen as a leader of?
Well, on agriculture, as I mentioned, Divya, I really think that the permanent solution on public stock holding for food security purposes is really long overdue. And to again set the context a little bit on this, the WTO's agreement on agriculture is historically recognized as one of the most asymmetrical agreements of the WTO. The modalities that led to this asymmetry has also been documented and written about. It was really in the context of what was, popularly called the Blair House Agreement between the US and EU, which formed the basis for reduction commitments by heavily subsidizing countries. Now, the base period for subsidy reduction that forms the fundamental basis of these modalities was 1986 to 88. And the reason that this period was chosen was precisely because the price of agricultural products during this period was low. So consequently, the subsidy calculation has always been based on what is called the aggregate measurement of support or AMS entitlements, which have turned out to be fairly high for developed country members, which kind of pegged it to the 86 to 88 reference price. Whereas for countries like India and other developing countries, there was, in the absence of, because they were the subsidies that were given at that point of time by India and the others was not really very much, there was a standard 10% de minimis clause limit that was put as the obligation of developing country members. Now, as with the ability to provide for and the need to provide for subsidies for certain very basic purposes, and in this case, it is really about food security purposes for livelihood security reasons, both for farmers and for consumers, India and the others are at the risk of breaching the 10% de minimis. And it's for this reason, and it's in this context, that the Bali Peace Clause was won by India and other developing countries in 2013. Significant achievement, but it is in the form of what we call a WTO decision. And that decision also recognized it is something which exists in perpetuity, but at the same time, it recognized that this is an interim solution. It's in the form of a decision. For greater legal certainty, what we need is to crystallize it and put it as an amendment to the WTO agreement. And this is what we call as a translating the Bali Peace Clause to a permanent solution within the WTO's AOA to essentially ensure parity and equity. And as I mentioned, there are close to 80 developing country members agreeing and presenting a very clear proposal on the permanent solution, but we are far from resolving this matter. Equally, you would have, read about the fisheries agreement at the WTO. That has been another area where, although there was some kind of progress that was made in 2022 on disciplines for illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing or IUU fishing, the subsequent disciplines or more comprehensive disciplines on overcapacity and overfishing has also been stuck in extremely tenuous negotiations. It's again a complex set of disciplines, and clearly it's while countries like India and other developing countries have been asking for a certain amount of special and differential treatment to be able to ensure subsidies for small-scale artisanal livelihood fish workers within the coastal region and within the EEZ, which is the territorial limits of a country. One of the most contentious part of the negotiations has been on what is called the distant water fishing. And this is where subsidies in this space has been dominated by countries like EU, China, Japan, South Korea, Chinese Taipei. This has been again well documented in papers written by the Pew Center and a few others. And India has been asking for accelerated reduction of such heavy subsidies in the distant water fishing areas by countries which have been the heavy subsidizers, a more accelerated reduction by them, and a greater timeline for countries like India to actually develop its capabilities in distant water fishing areas, which because it has its significant relevance not only for the purposes of fish as food, but also for various R&D purposes, etc. It's a complex set of disciplines, and what we need is balance, particularly to ensure that we do not end up in the asymmetries that we saw in the agreement on agriculture. And finding that balance is a work in progress. You mentioned investment facilitation for development, and that's an area where close to 123 countries have developed a text. Many elements of it actually resonates with what I mentioned earlier in terms of the domestic regulations for services. In the context of IFD, the Investment Facilitation for Development, this also extends to non-service sectors as well. Now, unlike the services domestic regulations, which can be incorporated as MFN disciplines within the GATS schedule of members, the IFD disciplines, the only entry point, the only way they can get into the WTO is if they get incorporated as a plurilateral, because not all members have adhered to it. There are fundamental questions in terms of whether investment facilitation is anything about trade at all, or is it a pure investment issue, whether there's a mandate to discuss all of it. And I'm not going to get into those fundamental questions. Let's take it that there are 123 countries that have endorsed the fact that there should be an agreement. But for this to enter into the WTO, it has to have consensus of all members. And that's where India has raised serious questions in terms of whether incorporating a plurilateral between a few members will actually lead to fragmentation of the WTO, whether the purpose of WTO should really be to focus on multilateral disciplines and not allow fragmentation of its own disciplines. And that's again a really significant issue which has been debated for the last few years and will continue to get further discussed. And perhaps we need some further clarity on how this should really evolve.
Thanks, Anu. Finally, to sort of look at the entire ministerial from a broader lens, the world today is a rocky road where trade is increasingly facing mounting challenges from geopolitics as well as geoeconomics. Global South and smaller economies have taken a hard hit from the shifting tumultuous landscape. In the context, how important are these biennial ministerial meetings, and what should WTO do so that even the smallest of its member countries reap the true benefit of multilateralism?
Well, I think, as I mentioned at the beginning, the value of multilateralism lies in the fact that, the WTO has provided a very sound basis for ensuring that a significant amount of trade that occurs worldwide is on an MFN basis. And there are rules on goods, on services, on technical regulations, on trade remedies, the manner in which that can be exercised, all of which have provided a very, very sound foundation. I think it's important to remember those achievements and celebrate that. I think the focus has been too much on newer issues, trying to overcrowd the WTO system itself with unreasonable demands in terms of what it should and should not achieve. And also in terms of, painting countries in silos. I mean, there is a fair amount of media bashing, particularly in the Western media, of how India has been an obstructionist on some of these issues. And I think that's a very unfair way of looking at it. We are really in a world today where there is a gradual, in a sense, a merging of a lot of interests, whether we look at it from a trade perspective or whether we look at it in terms of larger global challenges such as climate change, sustainability, etc. And there is a vision for fairness and equity, which is not really a Western-dominated vision. It's really about sustainability that works for all countries. So if you were to say, the way you phrased it, what should really be the focus in terms of the true benefit of multilateralism, I think it really has to, it really lies in acknowledging that there is no one vision of achieving those benefits. It's a question of actually listening to the voices of developing countries, their vision of what is sustainability, their vision of what their priorities are to achieve that sustainability, and to have a open discourse in terms of achieving that. So to that extent, yes, the biennial meetings are absolutely important because that is the key opportunity for the ministers to the heads of state to get together to thrash out many of the thorny issues. But at the same time, acknowledge that the period between those biennials are not silent faces. They're actually faces where a lot of action is happening in Geneva through permanent missions of each of those 166 members that are present there, their officers who are committed to actually ensure the continued relevance of the multilateral space. Well, so with that, optimistic note, I think here's looking forward to a far more, clearer vision at the next ministerial.
Thank you so much, Anu. It's been lovely talking to you. Thanks for sharing your rich insights. There's a lot of clarity now, I hope, for the listeners as well on knowing what these ministerials hold. We will continue to engage with you on the subject to leverage your expertise on it.
Thank you so much. Pleasure being here.
Thanks. You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also follow us on social media. We are on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. This year also marks ISAS's 20th year since its inception. We have planned several exciting initiatives and events during the course of the year to commemorate its momentous occasion. So please do keep a lookout for these announcements on ISAS website and social media. Thank you for tuning in and have a good day.